Hi, this is livemint.com and you are listening to the Mint's Editor Podcast, where he picks out his top stories for the week with me, Pritika Khanna, and Mint's editor, R. Sukumar. This week, we saw some good news coming from Bundelkhand, where after years of distress, farmers finally have some reason to cheer. And this also comes especially in the light of, we've seen two back-to-back droughts, and the latest IMD forecast shows that there's a 1% surplus since monsoon onsets.
I think we need to look at it not just from the perspective of Bundelkhand. I think we need to look at it from two other perspectives. One is the larger perspective of the agrarian crisis that has wreaked havoc on India over the last 2 years. And the second thing you have to look at is the impact this has on everything, from the sale of everything from soap to motorcycles to, I mean, anything that is sold in the rural economy. And I think if this monsoon had been bad, there would have been tremendous consequences at the economic level, but there would have also been tremendous consequences at the political and the social level, especially given that there is a state movement there. You don't want a situation where a group of people believe they will be better off in a state of their own, and they're going through a period of misery thanks to various extraneous circumstances. It just heightens the struggle, makes them feel very disenchanted with the existing regime. And who knows how that would have played out in the context of next year's UP elections. Sure. So I think this sort of restores the balance. Hopefully, everyone will start looking at far more substantive issues when it comes even to the elections next year. And of course, I think it's great news for the rural economy, because the last quarter results for Hindustan Unilever, which is the country's largest consumer products company, if you looked at it, the increase in volume sales, which is the amount of products they sold, was very low. The main reason for that was because the rural economy is not growing, and people are just down trading, where you move from an expensive product to a less expensive product. I think they're cutting usage, right? And that is worrisome. So hopefully this will sort that out.
The other issue that was in the news this week was incidents of Dalit atrocities, and especially in the light of the, you know, the incidents in Gujarat and in Uttar Pradesh. And this was also discussed in the parliament. The next story that looks at how such incidents are actually not new, and several protests have happened across the country over the years.
Except that they seem to be increasing in frequency, and they seem to be happening more, right? And I think that's worrying. Why is it worrying? It's worrying simply because it shows significant alienation among a large section of the Dalit population. Many of them want better for themselves. They want better opportunities. They want more, right? I mean, all of India wants more, right? I mean, it's a very aspirational society, which is the great thing about it. Young societies are always aspirational. But if you're a young Dalit person growing up, what are the options open to you? And I think over the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen many movements to sort of empower Dalits into doing various things, including setting up companies of their own, businesses of their own. There's a Dalit Chamber of Commerce, right? I mean, there's Dalit Foods that we wrote about this entrepreneur who's doing Dalit Foods, not just as a business enterprise, but also to send out a social message to say, like, listen, 50 years ago, if a Dalit prepared food, people from other castes wouldn't eat it. But here we have a company called Dalit Foods, which is putting out foods that are popular and people are consuming that, which I think is also a nice social message to send out. But I think this alienation that is evident, and these fissures that are becoming evident, and some people will say these fissures have always been there, it's just that they're being reported now. But the unfortunate thing is, even if they're just being reported now, the more you report, the more people think such incidents are happening, right? I mean, it just becomes, why have we all reported about it? Why have we done follow-up stories on it? Because it's there, it's in your face. And it reflects an alienation which is not good. Because you look at, and all of it boils down to just one thing. The larger inability of this country, of its leaders, of just about anyone, right, to meet the aspirations of people. Because you look at even protests by the Patels, right, in Gujarat. Or by the Jats in Haryana. These were significant agricultural communities. You had 2 years of an agrarian crisis. And these guys were out in the streets saying, we want more. One is, of course, agrarian crisis, incomes going down. Not particularly true in Haryana, because many of them have sold their land and they've become millionaires. But still, the other thing is young people, what are the opportunities for them? And there are no opportunities and they want to find something to do. And I think the government of the day should figure out some way to address this gap to make sure people don't feel alienated.
I think the other thing on the government's agenda at this point with the ongoing monsoon session is the GST. And one of the stories of the week talks about the economics of GST. What made you pick this story for the week?
We all know, we've been speaking about GST for a long time, especially at Mint. I think every week we have a GST story on page one of the paper, and the website carries so many GST updates. And the reason why we do that is exactly why we also did this story on the economics of GST. I think you'll have to look at what it can do for productivity. You'll have to look at what it can do for ease of transfer of goods across states, what it can do for transparency, because it won't be GST alone. It will be GST accompanied by a proper information system to make it possible. And I think the gains for the economy can be significant. Some people say 2 percentage points to GDP. Some people say 1.5% to GDP. But whatever it is, even if you add 0.5 percentage point to 2 trillion economy, I think it's very significant. And I think those benefits can't be ignored. You really have to do something to get them. And I think that's why the government is focused on getting GST through this thing. And if you look at various economic models that exist of taxation, and we've looked at some of the classical economic theory also in this piece that we did, and you look at the benefits of taking a system where you have multiple levels of taxes, completely divided market, and you sort of unify the market with uniform levels of tax, it definitely results in huge benefits. I mean, I know it's not exactly comparable, but if you look at the benefits both to the exchequer as well as to individuals from the first income tax reform that India did 3 decades back, where things were significantly simplified. I think it was done by VP Singh, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. The benefits were significant. Why? You simplify, you reduce the number of slabs or tax rates or everything else. And I think those gains, and to gain them, you'll have to get GST through. But the unfortunate thing is, it looked like some momentum was picking up, but then we've had these series of incidents. We've had the problems in Kashmir. We've had these controversy over Dalits in Gujarat and in Uttar Pradesh. And I think the narrative has changed again, hasn't it? You cover politics, so you know that. I mean, it's no longer... GST was center stage of the entire political conversation, and now these things have come. And that seems to happen at the beginning of every session. It's almost as if there's a jinx against GST.
But seeing that today we're getting signals again from the parliament that they're going to push to regional parties, do you think that this session might be able to finally get the final push?
We are eternal optimists in this newsroom, right? I mean, we hope that this will happen, because I think this is a great reform. And by now, it's a great reform, not just because inherently it's a good move, but also because it's become symbolic. It's one of those victories. It's a milestone. And you achieve that milestone, I think global investors will be thrilled. Global and rating agencies will be thrilled. In some ways, GST has become the watermark of legislative reform. And a government that gets it through can go out and scream from the rooftops that, listen, people were doubting our reformist credentials. Look at it. We've got this legislation through. So I think it's important from all those perspectives. The numbers looked very good at the beginning, right? I mean, there was just a narrow gap between what they needed and what they would have in the upper house. And it looked like people voted rationally, you would get it done. Let's see. Right, I'm hoping that the conversation shifts sharply back to GST again. I know that all these other issues are important, but I think you need to give equal importance to all these things. And GST has been hanging for so long, you have to get it through.
Moving on to e-commerce, the next story on Flipkart, Amazon and Jabong tweaking their models to fit the new FDI rules. But then you also, on the other hand, you have Myntra, which is yet to alter their businesses. This also comes within 3 months of the government allowing 100% FDI in e-commerce.
I think e-commerce is one of those areas which has always been heavily regulated. But the interesting thing is, no one has really bothered to enforce those regulations. Because if they had, and the reason they probably didn't is because they didn't want to hit the one business that seemed to be doing well in India, right? None of the others were really doing well. And you don't want to affect foreign investors. You don't want to make them feel that this country is difficult to do business in. But I think if they had tried to enforce existing regulations, they would have discovered that most e-commerce marketplaces were violating those regulations, right? And I think that needs to change, because one of the essential characteristics of a marketplace is simply that it is a marketplace. It's something that links buyers to sellers, which means the entity running the marketplace should ideally not own any of the sellers itself. And that was one of the things that was being violated for a long time. And then some of it was changed. And then to truly reflect the spirit of a marketplace, one of the new government regulations said you can't get more than a certain percentage, 25%, I think it was, from your largest reseller. And again, there were several e-commerce companies that were in violation of that. Sure, they had interesting corporate structures that might have meant some discussion before a legal forum, because they could have argued that they were not really breaking the rule. But the fact is, I think deep down in their hearts, all of them know that they were clearly in violation of the rules. And I think what has happened after the new rules came into place was it did two things. One, it made these people look seriously at cultivating more sellers. For instance, this is one of Amazon's stated objectives. Their aim is to get enough resellers onto the market. It's also a good thing because it will reduce anti-e-commerce sentiment. Because many of the resellers are guys who have retails offline, brick and mortar, mom and pop shops, somewhere, some corner. So you're essentially giving them an ability to sell online. And so you're reducing opposition to e-commerce in this country. Guys like Amazon are already doing that. But the other thing that the rules said was that you can't give discounts, right? And I think that's another thing where these companies had to figure out what to do. They seem to have figured out what to do because the sales are back.
Right?
The sales are back. So the discounts are back. So also, I'm not so sure that this is something that the government should seriously enforce. I think they should look at the reseller bit carefully. Discounts, they shouldn't, because if a pension fund in California wants to effectively subsidize me, I mean, what's the government's business? That's how it should be.
The next story is also from some good news for startups, with 10 venture capitalists testing waters in India again. But this also, I mean, we saw a surge, I mean, in the past, and those leaders have pulled back on the companies. So
that's right. Some of them have pulled back. And the reason I think they've pulled back is because there has been a period of reassessment. And this reassessment has happened, I think, over the last 12 to 15 months, where the VC firms looked at some of their big investments in this country and said, like, when will they turn profitable? How will they turn profitable? In this period, I think a lot of companies have worked on getting their business models right. They have allowed people to leave. They've cut costs. I think what you're now seeing is a sort of second wave of investment beginning to happen, largely from venture capital firms that were either formed later or were conservative or simply decided to ignore India the first time around. So these guys are coming in under more rational circumstances. The valuation is more rational. The expectations are also more rational. But I think they're also coming in because at this point in time, if you look at all the macroeconomic indicators and if you look at the entire Indian digital ecosystem, many of these venture capital firms believe that India is now where China was in 2005. And since 2005, between 2005 and 2015, the Chinese digital market, most of the e-commerce companies and everything else, really grew very rapidly. Alibaba became a force to reckon with in this period. Baidu became a force to reckon with in this period. Tencent became a force to reckon with in this period. And I think these new investors, and we saw 10 entirely new names, which I think is also, it should bring some cheer to entrepreneurs, because if you look at ROC filings, I'm told that there are fewer startups being incorporated today than they were being incorporated 2 years ago. And that is bad news for a country like India. We need to have more startups. And to have more startups, you need more funding.
Moving on to opinion pieces. The first opinion piece is on the backlash against globalization, which has begun in developed countries. This also comes at a time where we're seeing the rise of Donald Trump in the US and Brexit happening in UK.
And I think all of these are related. And in some ways, this is also related to the issue with Dalits that we discussed. It's another form of alienation. And I think, to me, the most interesting thing I learned from that piece, which I didn't know before, was that 60 to 70% of people in developed countries have, over the last 5 years, seen their salaries stay the same or fall. So if your incomes stay the same or fall, I mean, it's extremely bad. I mean, what do you have to look forward to? And the worst still, the column goes on to point out that this scenario is unlikely to change. That you're actually going to see even more people in developed countries whose incomes will fall. The beneficiaries, of course, have been people in developing economies in some sort of way. I think in developing economies like India, I think it's people who belong to the... I think the rich have benefited tremendously. I think the middle class has benefited to some extent. But I think even the poor have benefited to some extent, because both India and China have managed to get a lot of people out of poverty. I know there is a lot of controversy about poverty definitions in India, but the fact is, whichever way you look at it, some people who are poor are no longer poor, or are no longer that poor. So that change has happened. And I think what you are actually seeing in some developed countries is the inverse phenomenon. Some people who were middle class are now bordering poverty. And I think that explains why people are looking for unconventional choices. All of us were blindsided by Brexit. None of us, we all thought it was noise, right?
True.
I mean, none of us
True.
Thought it would happen. But it happened. When Donald Trump first said he wanted to run for president, we all thought it was a joke.
True.
I may still think it's a joke. But the fact is, he's gone through the process. He has been selected by his party to be their presidential candidate. His party thought it was a joke too when he started out, but then no one treated his candidature seriously 18 months ago. But now he is the candidate. Who knows? He may win. It's happened before in many other countries around the world. An unconventional candidate has won. And I think people are picking unconventional candidates. In Delhi, an unconventional candidate won too, right? And people picked an unconventional candidate because they were unhappy with the status quo. They thought they would get a new person who would help them solve problems. It reflects the kind of alienation that has crept into our society, the kind of distance between the people who rule and the people and everyone else.
All right. The next story also talks about getting some gender parity. Tata Motors is working to get more women on its
shop floors.
Yes.
And I think that's brilliant. You know that in our newsroom, 50% of our employees are women. It's one statistic I'm very happy about. I'm, of course, not so happy that our average age keeps increasing, right? I think it's because of people like me. But shop floors, traditionally, no place for women, right? That's how
Absolutely,
they've
yeah.
treated themselves. But over the last year and a half, I've actually seen an interesting change begin to happen, especially in some fairly advanced shop floors. Like, for instance, there's this company called JCB, and they do earth-moving equipment, so much so that in India, JCB has become like Xerox. It's become generic, right? I mean, you want something to be moved, someone will say, let's get a JCB. And they have a new factory in Rajasthan, I think somewhere near Alwar. They need welders. So all their expert welders are women. Right now, inconceivable. 5 years ago, I would have never thought that a big company producing heavy equipment or reasonably heavy equipment would use women as expert welders. But all their experts welders are women. The company's management tells me that they're doing very well, that they're very careful about how they work and the quality is good. GE has a new factory in Pune that makes a host of things from aviation to energy and locomotives. And again, many of the expert welders there are women. So I think you're beginning to see this change across factories. As the general physical labor component reduces, and as even shop floors start needing more expertise, more quality, and as shop floors automate further, because if you look at a car assembly line today, especially in a modern factory, the number of robots that are working on it are very significant. And to operate them, you need someone who understands various things and not just brute physical labor. So, and as a result of these things, I think you're beginning to see more women come onto shop floors. It's great that Tata Motors is looking at it because, again, it's a car company. And in many ways, car companies are at the apex of manufacturing, right? I mean, they're right at the top, especially given how complex it is to produce a car. The number of components that goes into a car are in tens of thousands. And to put it all together, and I think you will see more of that because you've already seen that in the service sector. And you'll begin to see this here. Of course, a country like China significantly improved the ratio because of its emphasis on soft manufacturing of electronics. Not soft manufacturing, but manufacturing of electronics. Initially, it was soft manufacturing, which is clothes and sneakers and everything else, where a lot of women got employed. But then they moved into electronic manufacturing, and then electronic manufacturing, this assembling that you need to do, I'm told that women do it a lot better than men. So many of these companies employ largely women. The Nokia factory in Chennai, for instance, employed only women in the assembling role. So I think if India can somehow get this Make in India business right when it comes to electronic components, more companies like Foxconn come in, you'll probably see even more women in manufacturing.
And this would definitely help in terms of jobs because it'll get a lot of women who are currently not in the workforce back.
Into the workforce. That's right. I think it's a good move. You should create opportunities for everyone, right? I mean, that's what being an equal opportunity place is about.
The last pick from this week is also about cars. The NGT recently has directed diesel cars older than 10 years taken off the road.
Correct, to be deregistered.
But this debate is not new. This is something that's been going on for about over three decades, and that's what the next story talks about. You know, the larger debate that's been going on the issue.
I think it's an interesting debate, and it's a debate to which, you know, there are many sides, depending on who you're speaking to. But I think at the core of it are two, three issues. The first one is, how clean are our fuels? And the answer to that simply is Indian fuels are not very clean, largely because of the way they are refined and the way they are produced and everything else. And I think that is one area where you can really focus on improving things, which the government is doing, right? They've set deadlines for what they call Bharat Stage 6 emissions. New manufacturers, all the companies which are launching new cars, will have to adhere to it from 2017, I think, right? And what this means is that the refiners, the guys who are selling fuel, will also have to start supplying that fuel. And that's a big challenge. Everyone tends to look at one aspect. They tend to not look at fuel. But I think fuel is an important aspect. The second thing is the science of it all. What causes pollution? To what extent are vehicular emissions responsible for pollution? The real answer, if one has to be very truthful, is we know they cause emission, but we do not know whether the problems of a city like Delhi are solely because of vehicular emission.
True.
I find it very difficult to believe that a country with so many smart people, with so many excellent scientific institutions, cannot launch a project to just identify the real causes of air pollution. I'm sure vehicular emissions will be responsible to it to some extent. But what are the other things? Are they responsible to it? To what proportion are they responsible to it? Do they cause 30% of it? Do they cause 80% of it? And science allows you to capture that information. So I think we've done the first part of it, which is that we've begun measuring vehicular emission. We've begun measuring air quality. And I think measurement is the first step of any investigation. But I think we need to progress further and look at it. There's a third aspect. A lot of it has also been distorted by our own subsidy structure and everything else, right? I mean, people have spoken about how everyone is driving SUVs with diesel engines. And that's because I think between 2010 and 2014, diesel was significantly cheaper than petrol. And so everyone went and bought diesel vehicles. Subsequently, of course, at one point in time, the sale of diesel vehicles accounted for 65% of all vehicles. That's come down to do that. Along with this, you also have to do enough things to push alternatives. So I don't know whether we are really doing enough to push the use of electric vehicles. I don't know whether we are doing enough in terms of public transport. Have we really made the right kind of investments when it comes to public transport? Sure. So I think it's a difficult question. I don't think it's a question that should be solely addressed by the courts. The courts have stepped in to address it because over the last 30 years, politicians have shied away from addressing this question because the auto lobby is a strong lobby. No one wants to get on the wrong side of the auto lobby. It's a tough question, but I'm sure left to ourselves, all of us would like to bicycle to work, right? But can you?
That's true.
I mean, you probably won't even reach office. So someone will knock you down. So there are various things that you have to improve before you suddenly say, because outside some of the metro stations, you see these bikes.
Yes.
And they're just lying there. They haven't moved. Someone just bought 10 fancy bikes. They colored them a nice color.
True.
Green, I think,
green.
In Delhi.
It's also because it's very tedious to get one also.
Yeah, I mean, the process is tough. And they're just there. I haven't seen anyone on one of those bikes.
True, very true. So those were Sukumar's top stories for the week. Do let us know what you think. You can email us at feedback@livemint.com. or follow us at LiveMint on Twitter and Mint on Facebook. Thank you for listening and see you next week.